Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by journalist, broadcaster and writer, Leslie Ann Jones. Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine. Loving your house.
Oh, yeah, well, we won't tell anybody where it is.
No. Your new book, Fly Away Paul, is coming out next month, is that right?
Yeah, the 19th of October.
And
this year sort of didn't exist because it was all about Paul McCartney and writing that book. And the time, it's sort of jumped from Christmas to now. The months flew by. The months and Paul flew by.
So this is Paul in the 70s primarily, is it? This is through the Wings career.
Yeah, it's the post-Beatles era before he discovered really that he was aiming to be a solo superstar. And he took a lot of criticism during that period, didn't he? Because people were saying that Wings were a construct, they weren't a proper band, they were just a vehicle for him to be trying out his solo songs without the Beatles. I think a large part of it was Paul trying to prove to John that he was still someone, because there was always a sense in each of them that the other one was outdoing them. And John had gone off the radar to some extent. You know, it was sort of time. The time is punctuated with issue from John. A lot of it driven by Yoko. They'd taken themselves out of the country. They're living in New York. Paul and John were physically separated for the first time in many years. And I felt that the Wings period was Paul reminding John he's still here. And actually, it got to the stage where Paul was bigger than John, in America especially, where John was living. He should have been the superior Beatle in America, in New York, but Paul was driving the narrative. So I really wanted to look behind that, at the personal relationships, the dynamics, the women, very much from a woman's point of view as well. So delving into emotions and feelings and family background and the extraordinary things that were going on in both of their lives, especially from John's point of view. I think people didn't realise at that time, because it wasn't talked about, was that John and Yoko relocated to New York primarily to find their daughter who'd been stolen. Because it was Yoko Ono's child, it wasn't really given very many column inches. People weren't that interested. They went on television in the States and they spoke about it, but even then no one really reacted. It was as though people didn't care because the child was hers. But as far as John was concerned, that was his daughter, and she'd been snatched and taken away. They never got her back.
Because that's been the narrative for so long, hasn't it? That John and Yoko moved to New York, and it was Yoko pulling him in that direction. But he was emotionally involved, big time.
Oh, very much so, yes. And if you think about the fact that they were probably the most famous couple in the world at that time, and with all their money, with their fortune, all their contacts, all the strings that they could pull, they never got the child back. And I find that horrific. I put myself in Yoko Ono's position and in John's position to work out how I would feel about that, and I think it would have driven me mad. And so a lot of John's music at that stage was in reaction to that trauma of their personal life. The thing about Yoko is that she didn't want Paul around at that stage. She wanted John to herself. She wanted him away from the world. She didn't want to share him anymore. Linda was the opposite. Linda understood the necessity for John in Paul's life. She made room for that. She was all for it. She was encouraging and shoved him in John's direction certain times. And she really nurtured that relationship. May Pang did the same. But Yoko seemed as though she didn't want Paul and Linda in their lives anymore. And so that was where friction came in, because John at a certain point became so dependent on Yoko and couldn't see a way of doing things without her. So 1976 is a really poignant year, because that was the last year, April that year, that Paul and John last saw each other. And yes, it's a sad year because of that. And Wings at the Speed of Sound is a sort of prelude to that. You know, massively successful, not as successful as Band on the Run. Venus and Mars wasn't as successful as Band on the Run, but you have your magnum opus, just as the Beatles had Sgt. Pepper, and people were saying, well, how do they top that? You don't actually top it. You move on and you do something else. The same as Fleetwood Mac couldn't top Rumours. You know, that there's always a stage at which you have to take a different direction. And I've always felt that Wings Speed of Sound was a slightly different direction for Paul, really. What was unusual about this album, and I don't think I knew this at the time because I just was too young, but it was the first time that Paul had conceded control.
Yeah, so the book is out next month. One thing I was going to say as well, your Stones book, which I thought was superb.
Thank you.
And the way you really cracked Mick Jagger, for example, you really cracked the personalities. And it's similar with your John book. Did you find it more difficult to get into Paul's head when you were writing about him?
If anything, I found it easier. I think Paul has been in my head for my whole life. And I think I was maybe always building up to this one. Does that sound pompous and or like a bit of a fantasy? Maybe I always knew that I would write about Paul McCartney at some stage, but I wasn't there yet. And then, of course, this big anniversary was coming up, the Band on the Run, 50 years of Band on the Run. How can that be? And it seemed the obvious time, actually, to take another look at the whole Wings decade and really see where that sits. Because, of course, he's had 50 years since the Beatles. More than 50 years. But he's been not a Beatle for longer than, way longer than he was one. And yet we still define him as a Beatle, the Beatle. That was interesting to look at. I also knew Linda McCartney. And I was at one stage having quite serious discussions with her about doing a book, about doing her biography.
Wow.
And I came up with a title which she absolutely loved, which was Mac the Wife. And
very good.
Yeah, she went for that. And when I first met her, I was hugely pregnant. Hmm. And it was at Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital. And she was there, she was not there yet when we were all there, all the press. I was working for a national newspaper at the time. And there I was, sticking out like this massive sore thumb in the front row of all these hacks from Fleet Street in the foyer. And she arrived looking absolutely gorgeous in this blue and green silk frock. And her hair, her blonde, gorgeous hair, it's all flowing down. She just always looked wonderful. She never photographed very well, Linda. Maybe she was a bit shy and she didn't much like being photographed. She was much more beautiful in the flesh. And she walked in through these sliding doors and spotted me the way a mother spots a pregnant woman. It's just an instinctive thing. She marched right over, lifted up the velvet rope from its hook, took my hand, and she said, "You're coming with me." And it was as though she realized instinctively that job would be very hard for me to do. This was, I mean, what kind of news editor sends a pregnant reporter,
I was going to say,
to the opening of a wing for terminally sick children?
Oh, wow.
You know, and she got that. She got it in a heartbeat, and she took my hand, and I walked around the wards with her. We shared a tissue at one point, and she was terribly kind to me, and she was asking me everything. She said, "Keep in touch. Let me know how it goes. Let me know what you have."
Really?
And
wow.
We kept in touch. And thereafter, whenever they had a launch or a little do at the Hard Rock Cafe or anything like that, she would always send me an invitation. And it would always say on the top of the invitation in her handwriting, "How's Mia?" who is the name of the baby, as turned out.
Oh, wow.
"How's lovely Mia? Stay veggie, you two." And she would draw hearts all over everything. And she sent me copies of her cookery books as well. And so one thing leads to another, you know, especially in a writer's mind, you know how we are. And I sort of felt there's a story here. There's an amazing story about this woman who took on one of the greatest musicians in history and took him on as her husband and as father of the child she already had. And then made a family with him at a time that he was breaking down mentally and emotionally. And he had this farm in Scotland on the Kintyre Peninsula, where I went.
Oh, you've been there.
And spent a fair amount of time up there, actually, and got to visit his farm and got to visit the studios where Mull of Kintyre was recorded. And went to all his old haunts and met people who knew him when he was up there and so on. But he'd bought it as a tax dodge, really.
Yeah.
You know, and with no intention of ever living there, but it was sort of, what shall I do with my money to sort of not be taxed too high? And Jane Asher it was who suggested, well, you know, you could buy these farms in the Lower Highlands, the Upper Highlands, wherever else, and property is a good way of offsetting tax. So up they went and they got this place, but he'd never lived there. And it was Linda's idea. Linda, who was a great lover of nature and wildlife and open spaces and animals and all the things that he'd never paid much attention to because he hadn't had time.
Yes.
This was very much her life, her obsessions. And she was the one who said we could go there, we could make it a home. And she loved it because it was on the edge of nowhere. It was literally nowhere land. You know, it was never land. It's a very harsh environment. I don't know if you visited, but the winters are, the days are short and the weather is tough and you can't get anything. You're 150 miles from Glasgow. The railway doesn't come within 100 miles. You can drive there or you can fly there. You know, and it's most people don't have the means to take a plane.
Yes, yeah.
But these people in that part of Scotland absorbed these superstars and just allowed them into their community and just made no fuss about it, didn't take much notice of them. They were respectful. They let them be. And that was exactly what Paul needed at that time. It wasn't so much what she needed at that time. And, you know, he was in a mess. He was far more disintegrated than we knew at the time, because all of this was going on away from our gaze. We had no idea that Paul McCartney was having a breakdown, but he was.
Yeah. Well, wasn't it the Life reporter? They turned up.
And they chucked a bucket of slop over her, and yeah. Then they had to negotiate, yeah. Allowing them pictures and a piece, an interview to offset his overreaction.
Yeah. However, 6 years later, he's doing much better. We're talking about Wings at the Speed of Sound, which was produced by Paul and released on the 26th of March, 1976. Actually, in the US, 4 days earlier than that. And it was basically recorded in between their world tour, that finished the European tour, just about to start the US tour. The lineup at this time is obviously Paul, Linda and Denny Lane, but we've also got Jimmy McCulloch on guitar and Joe English on drums. And interesting, yeah, like you were saying earlier, that all five of them get a song.
Yeah, it was. This was a turning point, really, because Paul had been seen as a control freak. Guess what? He is a control freak. He just is. He doesn't realise he is, but he is that. It would very much be Paul McCartney's album. This was where I think the whole myth about Wings being a vehicle for him as a solo artist, I think that's where this arose. Wings were a band, but it was a sort of ever-evolving lineup. But this was, for me, it was the strongest lineup, this one that embraced Jimmy McCulloch and Joe English. And so as a backslap to the critics, Paul decided everyone else would get a song on which they sang lead vocal. So that's what happened. And actually, all the vocals on this album are very strong.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's one particular surprise for me. But, and it's Abbey Road as well. He's returned to Abbey Road.
He's gone back to Abbey Road, home from home. That always rankles, doesn't it, a little bit? Because the feeling is that Abbey Road is about the Beatles. How dare Paul record there? But this is where you feel at home. This is where you do your best work. It's a bit like having your, for us, you know, your favourite computer, the desk that works best for you and the office that works best for you. It's only that kind of thing.
Someone knocking at the door. Somebody ringing the bell. Someone's knocking at the door. Somebody's ringing the bell. Do me a favour. Open the door and let him in. Ooh, yeah. Someone's knocking at the door. Somebody ringing the bell. Someone's knocking at the door. Somebody's ringing the bell. Do me a favor. Open the door and let him in.
So should we start with track one?
We can.
Recorded on 4th February 1976, Let 'Em In.
is obviously the one that starts with the doorbell ringing, and then it goes into this. He's inviting a lot of random people over his doorstep, isn't he? So you've got his brother Mike, you've got Linda's brother John, you've got Paul's auntie Jin, who's his dad's sister. Auntie Jin hosted Paul's 21st birthday party. You've got Phil and Dawn, who are the Everleys. Didn't even know that when I heard it the first time. Martin Luther, who's obviously not Martin Luther King, but the German priest from the Protestant Reformation, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Who,
yeah,
I think, hangs some of his theses on the door or something. That was the connection, supposedly. And Uncle Ernie, of course, who's Ringo Starr, who played Uncle Ernie in the Who's rock opera, yeah, Tommy, and that's where that character came from. And they're all just coming in, and you've got this great military drum beat as a sort of backdrop. You've got some amazing flutes on this.
Yeah.
Extraordinary flautation, if we can use that word.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit pompous, wasn't it? And it's a very kind of Moorish track. Billy Paul covered it.
Yeah.
Which was a bit of a surprise. Didn't have as big a hit with it. This was, what, number two in the UK, number three in the US from memory. And Billy Paul, I think you probably know, did the famous song Me and Mrs. Jones, which has always been a bit of a theme tune for me.
All right.
And but he changed the characters in it. So obviously none of Paul's listed people, apart from the famous ones, the Everleys and so on, would have meant anything. So he substituted Louis Armstrong, Malcolm X, these kinds of people.
Sister Susan, Brother John, Martin Luther, Phil and Don, Uncle Ernie, Auntie Jean, Robin and Don, little me.
Oh, yeah. I contacted Kate Robbins yesterday because she's
How
been.
How is she? I love Kate.
Oh, she's awesome. She'd been on before and she mentioned Sister Susie.
Oh, yeah, that's Susie and the Red Stripes, which was a sort of pseudonym that Linda recorded under Seaside Woman, yeah, was the track, wasn't it?
Well, she's also said Sister Susie was the nickname for Auntie Millie, who was Auntie Jim's sister. Also sister to my grandmother, Annie, and Uncle Jim McCartney too, along with four others. Right, here we go, family tree time. There were seven McCartney siblings: Jack, Edie, Ginny, Millie, Jim, Annie and Joe. Auntie Millie, aka Sister Susie, was married to Uncle Albert.
We're so sorry.
I never really understood why she was called Sister Susie by Auntie Jim. Perhaps it was a private joke.
Well, that's so interesting. How fascinating. Thank you, Kate. Obviously, that's why Linda called herself Sister Susie for Susie and the Red Stripes.
Yeah.
That has got to be, hasn't it?
I like the idea that it might be the ding dong at the beginning, a little reference to George, possibly. Don't know.
Don't know about that. Yeah, I mean, you could read so much into these things, can't you, really? But there's a very sexy trombone on this as well.
Yeah.
Which wouldn't necessarily work on any other McCartney track, but it works on this.
It does. Because I think Paul said this was quite a Christmas stocking filler of a song. He never really thought much, but he's still doing it to this day. And it's so catchy. And the middle eight, I adore. I think it really just pushes it to another level. Especially that, let him in.
Oh, nice voice. That's nice. I love it, you know, when he plays this live and you've got the flutes and the brass dotted around the auditorium, and then when it gets to their bit, they all stand up and it's sort of random, and suddenly you're looking around, go, oh yeah, look, there are the flautists, or, you know, look, there are the horns. It's very sweet. Even though you know it's coming, it's always a lovely surprise.
Later on, the story goes, a bottle floated out to sea after days when it had found the perfect spot. It opened up. And I read the note that you never wrote to me.
Next we have track two, The Note You Never Wrote. First song recorded for Wings at the Speed of Sound, the basic track, in October 75, and written by Paul, but sung by Denny.
Sung by Denny Lane. It's Yeah, lovely voice. I think I didn't realise for years that it was Danny Lane. I thought that it was Paul. Just Paul doing another voice, because he had a variety of voices and levels, and he could project characters very well, couldn't he? So I think I just assumed that this was Paul all those years, but of course, no, found out eventually it's Danny Lane. Quite obscure lyrics.
Yeah.
So you've got a bottle floating in out to sea. Is it that there's no note in it, or is it that the note written in it is to somebody else and not him? I've never managed to
work that out. I have no idea.
That out. I don't get it. You've got sublime backing vocals from Linda on this.
Oh, yes.
Everyone who ever says she can't sing, well, get stuffed. You know, she really, actually, her harmonies on this are beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
They just loved to hate her, didn't they? And they would hate her regardless of what she came up with. It must have been very hard for her to live with.
She seemed to be water off a duck's back. But that's how it always comes across in interviews. But I'm sure at home...
I don't think it was like that at all. I think she took so much of it to heart. Yeah. I mean, especially in the early days when she was living with Paul in St John's Wood, and people would scrawl obscenities on the wall opposite the windows of the house. So she would have to come down in the morning in a dressing gown and slippers to make the tea, look out on that, and then go out there and face these people who used to hang around all the time outside his place, and walk Heather, her little girl, to school. Imagine that. You know, she was really young herself. She's only in her 20s at this stage.
It's that scene in Get Back where you see Yoko and Linda talking. And everybody's, what are they talking about? I reckon it's probably that. What's it like going out with a Beatle?
Yeah, maybe. But, I mean, for me it shows the depth of love between them, because who would deliberately subject themselves to that? It begs all the questions, really. There was never any question that she was completely devoted to Paul. They were joined at the hip. There was very rarely a time whenever I saw them that they weren't actually physically touching in some way. So whether they were holding hands or sitting beside each other, one would have their hand on the other one's leg, or they'd be sort of cozied up, or even if they were talking to people in opposite directions, their shoulders would be joined or something like that.
Yeah.
Very, very rarely separated, conjoined like twins.
Does Danny Lane get much coverage in the book?
He does. He's obviously an integral part of Wings. Always a tricky character. There was a huge amount of disgruntlement and resentment in Danny. I think he always believed that he should have equal billing with Paul, that he was an artist on a par. They'd known each other a long, long time, from before, as they always used to say.
Yeah.
But I mean, when the call came from Paul for him to come and join him and create this new setup that turned out to be Wings, he was sleeping on a mattress on the floor in his manager's office, you know, in the back office there, and didn't have two pennies to rub together. Was never any good with money. Ended up bankrupt years later. He would always whine and say that Paul didn't give him his due, that he didn't get what he deserved, and that sort of thing. I think a large part of it was that he just spent it. He was very bad with money. I knew him. I did get to know Danny in the early 2000s, and a bunch of his... I also know his daughter, Heidi. Heidi Jo Hines, whose middle name was kind of after her mother. She was Jojo Lane, obviously. And Danny and Jojo did end up getting married, but that was a whole other story, because Jojo, she was an American model, I think you know, and she'd been mad about McCartney, obsessively mad about Paul, since she was very young. And her mission in life was to get to meet Paul and get him to marry her. Paul's married to Linda by this time, but she got herself to the south of France where they were playing, and she infiltrated the setup. I think she got together with one of the roadies first and then graduated to Danny. Danny never realized that Jojo was using him to get to Paul. Linda knew from the off.
Right.
She always knew what was going on. And for that reason, she would exclude Jojo from certain things. She wasn't allowed to be in the video for Mull of Kintyre, for example. And Danny would complain and say, Linda doesn't like Jojo. Well, no, she didn't, because she knew what she was up to. And I think Jo was probably the only serious contender, the only real threat to Linda's relationship with Paul, as far as Linda saw it. Paul probably never even noticed and batted her off like a fly if ever she came close. But I think Denny, once he realised that, because he did say years later, he admitted, I never knew that that's what it was all about, that that's what she was up to.
But so they spent a lot of time during London town when they're on the yacht, and there was allegedly stories there about friction. So it must have been very difficult for Linda.
Yeah, very difficult. But, you know, Danny was no angel, and there are stories in the book about his extracurriculars as well. So I think the great success of Wings really has to be on the back of the relationship between the two McCartneys and the fact that they were the backbone and they were joined at the hip, and they kept the whole thing going by staying together. You know, it was never a question of Paul going off on the road and leaving the missus behind, which is what Denny did a fair bit of.
The Note You Never Wrote, I love this song. It's got such an eerie, surreal start, and it just doesn't really go where you expect it, and it's sort of hidden away on this album. I think it's such a good song. Really,
it's an amazing song. It's not a typical Paul song, but you can sort of picture this guy on the beach at night, and the bottle is washed up on the pebbles and so on, and the expectation that it's from the love of his life. And either, as I said, either it has no note in it at all, or it has a note that's for somebody else. That's the unanswered question about this song.
And also a Jimmy McCulloch incredible solo as well.
Oh, extraordinary. So sad when I think about Jimmy as well. It was so effortless for him. There was a touch of genius there, but there was also Danger Man. There was a huge propulsion to self-destruct, and that was fairly obvious there from the start, wasn't it?
My baby, she comes out at night, she's taking me by surprise. She's my baby, like gravy down to the last drop, mopping her up, yeah, yeah, she's my baby. She's a baby in the morning time, when the sleep is in her eyes, then the world is waking up, she has arisen. Oh, believe me, I ain't lying. She's a woman.
Next we have track 3, She's My Baby, or Bebe.
She's my baby. I used to always love that, how he says that. She's my baby. Yeah, it's, I keep mopping it up. Yeah. It's, what was it, like gravy down to the last drop? It's, not the most profound lyrics, I suppose, that he'd ever written, but, I mean, it's all any of us wanted to hear from Paul McCartney. She's my baby. It's, everyone was so madly in love with him, and please call me that. Please Paul, call me that. Such a cute little love song, isn't it? It's quite simple, but it's nice, it's skippy, it's got this nice little bass and the nice simple drums. It's not too demanding of the listener.
Not at all.
But it's cute. Do you agree?
I do. I think the lyrics are very risque as well.
There's a bit of double entendre in there, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow, Paul.
He got away with it.
He did, in such, and you wouldn't pick it up in this sort of song as well. But yeah, gravy kind of, yeah. It rhymes, but it's probably not the best if you close your eyes trying to picture that.
Well, no, but I suppose Linda being the cook of the house, and it was all about food and creating meals out of nothing, and gravy is a particularly resonant comestible. You know, you're going to get gravy on everything in Liverpool at that time, on your pie and chips. You're going to get gravy on your chips and egg. You're going to get gravy on your roast and whatever else. So I think gravy was probably quite a symbolic thing for him. Or am I overthinking this?
No, keep going. But yeah, Paul loves mopping it up. And so does Linda, I guess.
Mopping it up. He always loved the naughty kind of, slightly kind of, tee-hee aspect of sexual things in lyrics and so on. I mean, there are so many. There's a whole section in my book about John on those. It would have appealed to him, just as the whole, you know, there's this myth about Kintyre. If you look at the Kintyre Peninsula on the map, what it actually looks like.
Right.
And I won't go into it, but if I just refer to the angle of the dangle, let's say, you can imagine what I'm talking about. But Paul would have found that, maybe, I mean, being extreme, maybe that's even why he chose to go and buy a farm there, because there was that association.
Yeah.
It would appeal to his cheeky schoolboy sense of humour.
I love that.
In some ways. The angle of the dangle. Yeah.
Next, we have the drama of Beware My Love.
Now, this is the only real rock song on this album. On the album we called the Watsauce album, as in Wings at the Speed of Sound.
Okay.
Because you've got to have an acronym, haven't you, in anything and everything. You've got your quite churchy bit at the start. This sort of insistent, haunting acoustic guitar. Paul's obviously on lead vocal. Linda's voice is prominent in this. You know, you're very aware of her on this. And it's about a guy warning the woman he loves off the guy she is with, because he's saying he's not the one for you. And he's suggesting, actually, I'm the one for you.
Yes.
And it's a bit disjointed, I suppose. It's got Paul's screaming vocal, that wondrous, huge rock star vocal that we've come to expect from him, which, you know, he can't quite deliver it anymore. But I think we hear it, even though he can't scream to that extent anymore. I think when we see him live, we still hear that.
I thought exactly the same at Glastonbury, watching that. In my head, I was hearing something different. I know what you mean. I can't
totally.
Really
You're not hearing them as they are now. You're hearing them as they were then. Mm. But you're experiencing their presence, their aura, their essence, and soaking him up. Because let's face it, we won't have that many more years to enjoy him live.
I know.
And we won't stop crying about that now, because it will get to us all. Yeah. You've got a great bass on this. You've got wondrous drums. Linda and Denny on the backing vocals. It really, for me, showcases the rocker in Paul. And he's the only rock star in the Beatles, really. I always thought that. He's the only actual rocker of the four of them. A load of people will disagree with me about that, but I've always thought that. That's just my personal opinion. Jimmy's amazing guitar on this. Denny's great piano. Joe's brilliant drums. There's a version that Paul did with John Bonham from Led Zeppelin, isn't there? Which didn't get released at the time, but they released it eventually in the Archive Collection box set, 2014. Yeah, which is something else.
It is.
Really. Yeah. You know. A parody in its way, but I've often thought as well that a large part of Paul's output is parodying other music. It's not quite a little send-up, but it's maybe a gesture, a nod, a sort of little poke of fun, but he's not afraid to caricature music, is he, at all?
Oh, not at all. I mean, the way he sings this, I mean, I love it, because as an actor, I've never really, I wouldn't put him up there with Olivier. Really.
But you wouldn't?
No. controversial. But as a singer, he's an actor as a singer, I think, because this he's playing a role, and it's like a operatic drama. You know, he's like, I must be wrong. You know, it's over the top, and I love it. And he does that in so many songs who play a different character. So I think he's a better actor as a singer than he is as an actor.
But I think he doesn't just do that when he's singing, performing, or recording either. He does it just when he's being Paul. I run into him a few times at different things, and even though he's 81 now, he's still got this gauche, quite charming, little boy demeanour about him. He's, you know, he's not a 20-something age Beatle anymore, but he still carries that character and projects that character, and we respond to that character in him.
Yeah,
he's not an old man, and he will never project that. So I think you're right, there's a ton of acting ability in there.
Yeah, as an aside, this song really reminds me of the da 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 of Reach Out, I'll Be There by the Four Tops.
Actually, you're right.
I think there's a lot of that in there.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they say there's nothing original now, don't they? But how could there possibly be? Every time I write the word "the," I'm obviously ripping somebody off, because Shakespeare wrote "the" before I did. Yeah. Not that I'm comparing myself to Shakespeare, by no means. Why don't Uncle can say no? Why don't Uncle eyes aglow?
Final track on side one, written by Jimmy McCulloch and Stone the Crows drummer Colin Allen. It's Wino Junko, sung by Jimmy.
He sings it very sweetly, I think. It's a neat little song, this. He has a nice voice. It's about his life. He is a wino, and he is a junkie, or a junko, as he calls him here. It's in the lyric, can't say no. This was Jimmy's downfall. And I think he sort of predicted his own demise in this song. Yeah. It's a what are you going to do kind of song, isn't it? I know what I am, who I am, and I can kind of see what's coming, but I can't stop anyway. So there's a poignancy to it, which makes it quite difficult to listen to now. Obviously, at the time, he was still living, he was still going strong, but knowing what happened to him and what a sad demise he had at such a young age. It's got a wonderful ending. It's got this guitar riff that seems to... Now, is this me hearing things, or does this riff appear later on Michael Jackson's Black or White?
Oh.
Give that a listen, because I think it's very similar.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So Michael Jackson, actually, he was a big fan.
Michael Jackson had every reason to rip Paul McCartney off in so many more ways than one.
Exactly, yeah.
But have a little listen to that. That could be just me hearing things. But I love this fantastic wild jam at the end, and the way it kind of speeds up and it just carries you away. It's the experience of the alcoholic and the drug addict, isn't it, really? All in one, encapsulated in a song.
See, I always think of Venus and Mars, this album, and Wings Over America. I always think of those as part of the same thing, because Venus and Mars, you've got some of the other members singing with a view to performing them live. And this is definitely done to be performed live. So the three of them together. And Jimmy, his life on the road, it was a troubled time for him at this particular time.
There was that great story about him at the when they were in Paris, the Georges Sank. Having an altercation with, of all people, David Cassidy in the bar and beating each other up. And, of course, Jimmy ended up with a broken finger and so couldn't go on. They couldn't play because how could you play with a broken finger?
They had to postpone all the gigs.
Well, yeah, but just, yes, they did. And just uncontrollable, just without that self-control. He was a lovely little guy, actually, wasn't he? And it was such a shame what happened.
Yeah.
They all fell out up in Scotland, didn't they, when they were doing Mull of Kintyre. Mm. and he stormed off. And he did express his regret, and he wanted to go back. But I think it's mythology, really, but a story about Linda had a basket of eggs in the kitchen on the farm, and he was lobbing the eggs up against the wall and smashed them all, and she was horrified, and he's got to go. But I don't actually think that's true. It sounds made up to me.
Yeah. There was an argument in a previous song, Incarnation of Wings, where Jimmy was completely out of order, but Paul stuck up for Jimmy, who was completely in the wrong. And so he seemed to have this sort of paternal kind of thing over Jimmy.
I would say very much so, yeah. But Paul did also say in the end that Jimmy was a danger to himself.
Yeah. We had to go, because he refused to go on for an encore as well.
Yeah. That's what the booze will do to you. Unfortunately, and all the rest, yeah. God rest Jimmy, though.
So young.
Amazing guitarist, yeah.
And a brilliant guitarist. There's something about guitarists called Jimmy, I think. Just call your child Jimmy.
Jimmy
and
be Page.
Awesome.
Who else you got?
Hendrix.
Oh, yeah, I suppose. Yeah, I never think of that as being a Jimmy because it's a different spelling.
Yeah. Jimmy Taylor, James Taylor. No, forget it. Forget that theory.
Yeah.
There's only other one Jimmy
down
I know.
The hole, yeah.
And I ain't going to go down that path.
No.
But yeah, so sad to lose him so young.
Very much so.
Much underrated guitarist.
It makes you wonder, doesn't it, a bit, what would have happened if, speculate, had Jimmy not died, had he not quit Wings, had he continued with the band that he really loved? And he adored Linda as well, and she was, you know, mother figure to him as well. What would have happened? We all know why Wings came to an end. We all know about Paul's arrest, the irony there, that he was the big druggie who was smuggling his stash into Tokyo, and that's really why it all fell apart. But would he have done that? He also has hinted at the fact that he may have pressed the self-destruct button himself.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't really know.
I can see him being in something like Kilburn and the High Roads, or I think he'd be great in the Blockheads.
Oh, yeah.
And Jimmy McCulloch there, doing the pub rock circuit, perhaps.
But I think he probably, a bit like Danny, always felt that he was more important to the mix than he really was. It was all about Paul, wasn't it? And resentment does creep in, especially after a few winos.
I'm Paul Muldoon, a poet who, over the past several years, has had the good fortune to record hours of conversations with one of the world's greatest songwriters, Sir Paul McCartney, reflecting on everything from the Beatles to Wings. The result is our new podcast, McCartney, A Life in Lyrics. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
So next we have a song written by Paul while he was on holiday, Silly Love Songs.
Yeah, I love this. Yeah, the single, this was interesting, had Cook of the House on the back. So very nice for Linda. It was written in response to a load of critics, a load of people, especially John Lennon, who said, all Paul ever does these days is write silly love songs. So he writes a song about it. Why wouldn't you if you're Paul McCartney? It was his 77th American number one. Or was it 27th?
27th, I would have thought.
Yeah. I don't exaggerate ever at all about anything. I want it to be 77th.
I wish it was.
Yeah, it must be 27th. Doesn't matter anyway, it was a lot. But it's a good live song, because it's a very lively, I think, and what he's saying here is, what's wrong with that? It's in the lyrics. What's wrong with writing a love song? Why not a love song? It's got this very throbbing, insistent bass line, which is very him, isn't it? So it's, oh, yeah, it's kind of, to some extent, it's not a love song, it's a sex song. This is an erotic song. It's a driving number. It's very Paul, who's a very sort of virile man, and he's showcasing his goods in this, really, if I can dare say that on your podcast. He has said that it's his favourite song. Whether, again, he's sending himself up in that, I've got no idea.
He also said that his favourite Beatles song was "You Know My Name, Look Up the Number." So,
well, yeah, so we take it all with a pinch of salt.
Yeah.
It's got a groovy horn section, which, you know, very Moorish again. Apparently, he let the horn players come up with their own parts, very unlike Paul. He'd normally prescribe all of it and make them all go away and learn it, wouldn't he? Yeah, it's, I suppose this is the song that pops up when you want to think of a jolly Paul McCartney song, silly love songs. You're driving along in your car, this comes on the radio. Oh, great, haven't heard this for ages. And it's a feel-good song, isn't it?
Yeah.
Massive hit.
Huge. It went to number one 3 times in America.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that tells you quite a lot about the American market, I suppose. Mm. The fans and the consumption of... But Paul, as a solo artist, just post-Beatles, was always way bigger in the States than he was here, because people here were still so angry about the Beatles breaking up. And the emphasis was only ever on, when are you guys getting back together again? Which is very dismissive and quite rude about all the other music that he's created.
Yeah.
They're bastards. I mustn't say that.
Oh, it's just such a huge song, isn't it?
No, it's wonderful.
Have you heard Al Green's Sha-La-La?
Yeah, it's in this very similar vein, huh?
Yeah, very similar.
Go on, sing it.
I can't sing it. I'll play it.
If I sing, you'll throw me out of my own house.
It's more about the arrangement.
Oh, he's going to pull it up on the old Spotify.
Get the old thingy out.
Excuse me? Don't panic, ladies and gentlemen. It's the same.
Oh, that's different.
We all know where he got the inspiration for that, don't we?
A homage,
perhaps. An homage, as they say in France. Yeah.
With Linda on vocals and the sound of bacon frying, we've got Cook of the House.
I know, it is. It's bacon and chips sizzling in the fat at the beginning and the end of the song. It sort of phase it in and phase it out, doesn't it? I never even realised that when I listened to it when it first came out. This is also on Linda's posthumous album, Wide Prairie. It came out the year she died, 1998. It's got a very 1950s rock and roll vibe, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's a lovely little song. Paul apparently used the same double bass on this as played by Bill Black on Elvis Presley recordings.
Yeah.
So what did he buy that bass?
Linda bought that for him.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And it's probably, and I really want it to be, Harry Casey on sax.
It is.
Yes. I saw Harry Casey the other day only.
Did you?
Because he was playing at the Mark Bolan anniversary tribute gig at Shepherd's Bush Empire. It's an annual thing, except they couldn't have it last year because the guy who plays Mark Bolan, this guy called Daniels with his band T-Rexxtasy, and he had to have an eye operation. So they postponed it to this year. Brought loads of characters on, so you had Mark Almond and Donna Gillespie and all kinds of people. Tony Visconti conducting the pretty little strings and Howie Casey in the back there on sax, and you just think, wow.
It's still here.
My man. It is. It's
still doing it.
It brings a lump to your throat, really. They came up with this song in Australia at a house they were renting while they were on tour there. And apparently there was a plaque on the kitchen wall that suggested some of the lyrics to them. And it's Linda, it's about Linda, really. Of course it's about Linda. Linda was a feeder. She was a cook. She was a great cook. A basic, homely, family cook. But she could always rustle up a meal out of next to nothing in a very short time. And yeah. It was all... Feeding is about love, isn't it? We equate those two things. It's a very loving thing to do, is prepare food for people and to feed them and to see them eat what you've created. Bizarrely, inevitably, it was seen as an anti-feminist yes. song at the time,
yeah.
which is a bit sad, isn't
it, really?
What are
your thoughts on that?
If you see it, then it's there. You know, you can see, read anything into anything, can't you, really? But if Paul had been the cook of the house, nobody would be saying that about him. So I think it's sexist, really. We weren't so angry about that kind of stuff yet.
Well, Alice was born out for the rest of her life. It was her passion. It wasn't... why would she sing about anything else? Yeah. That was her passion.
What if she was an amazing gardener and a cultivator of, well, I know they like to grow weed on their farm in Scotland, got done for that, but, you know, what if gardening was her passion, or tinkering away under the bonnet of a car? What would that make her? A diesel dyke? Yeah. You know, you can see anything in these things, can't you, really?
And the production, it's like an old mono 1950s yeah. skiffle.
I think that's what it's meant to sound like. It's a bit of a send-up, really. Again, it's a sort of... It's a blatant, okay, homage, your lovely word, but a blatant rip-off of 50s rock and roll. The sort of music that Paul cut his teeth on in the very first place, Paul and John.
And I love the inclusion, because you think, like, Wings, this is probably the peak of their career, I'd mm-hmm. say, 1976. They're huge. I think they made...
It was the pinnacle, wasn't
absolute
it?
Absolute pinnacle. And to throw something like this on the album, I find wonder. It reminds me of Yoko's We're All Water, like throwing that on sometime in New York City, knowing that it'll piss all the old long-haired hippies or whatever.
Totally. But
and they don't care.
Yeah, he's John Lennon, can do what he wants. He's Paul McCartney, he can do what he wants.
Yeah.
His wife is in this band, A, because the band was her idea in the first place. You've got to get back on the horse, you've got to make another band, do something else. He wasn't ready to be a solo artist then. But he turns around and says, I'll only do it if you'll be in it. Somebody who has no musical background, no instrumental training, never has sung anything beyond Three Blind Mice or whatever from childhood, you know, just so jumping in at the deep end together and making something out of nothing. It's the essence of the whole of Wings. And yeah, probably Mischief as well. I'm going to put this on because I know everyone's going to hate it. Even though, actually, I don't hate it. You don't hate
it.
Yeah,
I think it's great.
It's a good song, you know. But
it's had a lot of criticism.
Of course it has. But so did the album. So did all the albums. And so did the whole episode that was called Wings.
Yes, yeah.
Because all they wanted was the Beatles. Get over it.
If I had...
I can't even remember.
Do you want to
play
a bit?
We could stick it on, yeah. Let's stick it. I played this whole album this morning and
yeah,
it was
do you know what?
Denny sings it, I remember that.
Yeah.
I can't remember much about this song, to be honest.
It's just like, keep me hanging on.
Yeah.
Oh, actually.
Set me free, why don't you, babe?
Actually, yeah, I do quite like this one.
So it feels a little... I know it was the 70s. It feels a little bit 70s.
Yeah.
It has sort of stayed in its time.
Can I just... did I introduce it? I can't remember if I introduced it. Did I?
Yeah, this is Time to Hide. Yeah. It's Denny again, isn't it? It's Denny trying a little bit too hard, maybe... Is that unkind? Well, it doesn't but do then a lot.
You would, wouldn't you?
Yes, of course you would. If you're up against Paul McCartney in a recording studio, yes. And you've convinced yourself that you're as good as he is. What can I say?
I do like this, because the last few songs on Side 2, they're probably the weakest ones. But every time
I don't know. We're coming to those.
Oh, no, actually, yeah.
We're coming looking to at those. That.
But, yeah, this one's always been... I can never remember how it goes. And I
that's
have to
exactly
play it.
Right. It's exactly because I played the whole album twice this morning. And just to refresh my memory, although I know most of the songs by heart of all the albums, but this one just didn't sit in my brain. Maybe because it's not Paul.
Yeah, that was the problem when I first got the album, actually. I did skip everyone that Paul
it
didn't
wasn't
sing.
Paul.
So yeah. I missed most of the album for
See,
a long
that
time.
That is poignant.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I bet we weren't the only ones who did that.
Could be. But this one, every time I play it, I think it's great.
Yeah, it's not thrilling
it's
me.
Time.
You know, yeah, it stayed in the 70s. So much of Paul's music hasn't. It's just kind of carried on coming with him. It's just sort of back there. It just somebody English singing with an American accent always jars a little bit with me. There's right. no need for it.
Didn't the Beatles do that? Oh, no, I suppose it was a Liverpool accent, wasn't it, really?
It wasn't Americanized, was it? It wasn't that Rod Stewart thing, was it?
Oh, no.
That, I always admired David Bowie so much for that, because he never succumbed.
No.
He always sounded English and articulated like a good London estuary boy.
Yeah.
I've just seen another sunset on my own. All day long I've been alone. And I must do something about it. Yes, I must do something about it. Played another losing card game with myself. Lonely joker on a shelf. And I must do something about it. Yes, I must do something about it.
Next. Hidden Gem, written by Paul, but with Joe English on vocals. It's Must Do Something About It.
It's about the loneliness of the singer. You've got this guy playing cards by himself, and he's watching a beautiful sunset all on his own. And he's saying, I must do something about it, as in, I've got to do what Paul did by getting Linda. I've got to have somebody to share all this with. It's the basic fundamental need, and it's a stark song because of that. I think Joe sings this brilliantly. It's very hearty and it's very real. Yeah. It's like a Lancashire hot pot of a song, really. It's just sort of brimming with
gravy.
That as well. But a lot of people said at the time that it was the biggest surprise on the album. I don't know whether that was positive or negative. I was pleasantly surprised by this vocal, by this otherwise silent drummer who just kind of sat there at the back.
Yes.
There was a lot more to Joe English than people knew.
Because I think the story is that it'd all been recorded. Paul did a demo with him singing on it. And
he overheard him, didn't he?
Yeah, singing. And he was singing. I thought, actually, that's really
good. Yeah, that's really
and
good.
And his vocal, I'd rate him up with Paul.
Yeah, it's a lovely
such
vocal.
Such a brilliant vocal.
It really is. It's a lovely vocal.
He sounds a bit like Billy Joel.
No one seems to need my vocal. Has to change, you know. No one here to hold my coat. Oh, what a day. Oh, I've just watched another movie on TV. No one's in the house but me. And I must do something about it.
Yeah, there's a purity to it, isn't there? Yeah. And it's sad, really, as well.
Yeah, because he said he was feeling the same way himself, so it was very sort of poignant to him. Because eventually he did quit just to go back home because he was homesick.
He did.
Was saved, became a born-again Christian.
Yeah, he found God and his life changed. So maybe it wasn't just about finding the love of a good woman, but, you know, about finding the path to enlightenment and those kinds of things as well, which I hope he did find.
Seems so. I think he made about a dozen Christian rock albums.
Yeah.
So I've got to dig those out now. Because his voice, I just love his voice.
I'll wait here while you do that.
I'll report back.
You've got a lot, and from what you've got, I'd say you're doing well, dear. Dressed like a dream, and if things are what they seem, you're looking swell, dear.
Next, track 10, Sam Ferian.
I love this song. I've actually written about this song in my forthcoming book as the gem of the album.
Really?
It's, again, the hidden things, aspects that we didn't realise at the time. I didn't know that it was a sort of naturalised spelling of the French phrase, ça ne fait rien, meaning it doesn't matter. I didn't know that at the time. Ça ne fait rien just sounded like a woman's name. It's very French infused, it's very brass heavy, it's trumpety, it's cacophonous, it's the vocal is pure Paul, unmistakably, gorgeously clear as a bell, pure Paul. And the sentiment's very uplifting as well. You know, let your feelings leap away into the laughter. That is another nothing to get hung about.
Yeah.
That's what that is for me. I love this song. It's, play it again, Sam.
he was sort of saying that it recalling back to Michelle by having that sort of French Parisian kind of feel. He did the same thing on London Town as well. But yeah, he does occasionally dip his toe into La Mer.
Liked a bit of French. He went on that famous journey after John's auntie gave him some money for his 21st birthday, and they went, and that was where they got the Beatles haircut, as it became, for the first time. Yeah. And, you know, that to those 1940s Liverpool boys would have seemed like such a stretch of culture and magnificence. It's a whole other world, isn't it? I was in Paris for a couple of years when I was a student, and I remember being so thrilled to be going there because the whole French experience seemed the epitome of sophistication and grace and art and culture and fashion and magnificence and just everything that I'd not really experienced. So imagine how those boys took to that. And I think that sort of leaning towards that the morceau of Frenchness, I think he probably has always been attracted by that. And of course, he developed a great love of New Orleans later in his life. And of course, that is a French city. The architecture, the cuisine, everything is founded on the French influence from way back. Mm. And that would be a very strong reason why he took to New Orleans so enthusiastically.
Yes, I thought of that.
But I don't think he speaks French otherwise. I don't think Paul speaks any other foreign language, not fluently anyway.
No, he said he didn't study at school. He said, it's got a quote here, most British kids did. John did. He wasn't very good at it, mind you. But he chose Spanish, German and Latin.
But if you think about schoolboy French or schoolboy any language, well, Latin they didn't speak for a start. As a dead language, but schoolboy French just about gets you a beer, doesn't it?
I'm trying to think. I don't think I could even order that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Google.
If you say to my son, can you order a beer in French? He'll say, una cerveza, por favor. Oh, no. French, Henry, French.
A love so warm and beautiful stands when time itself is falling. A love so warm and beautiful never fades away.
And we end. With warm and
what a treat.
Beautiful.
Oh, because there are no good songs on the second side of the album at all, are there, Chris? Warm and beautiful. This is an amazing love ballad. It's obviously Paul wrote it before and about Linda. It's not quite Maybe I'm Amazed on the McCartney album, the best song that Paul ever wrote for her, the song he said he'd like to be remembered for. And then you start thinking, what are all the other songs that Paul's written for and about Linda? Well, he wrote loads and loads, but the ones that stick out for me, The Lovely Linda, that first little bit on the McCartney album, My Love on Red Rose Speedway, gorgeous song, Two of Us, Eat at Home on Ram,
another rude one,
which is a very sexy song, isn't it? But warm and beautiful. It's everyone is saying this, shades of Imagine, shades of John's song called Love. It's deliberately simple, a little bit plodding, a very slowed down pace. It's contemplative. And you just touched your heart there when I...
No, I touched my stomach because
it was
rumbling.
Oh, you touched your belly. I've got to show you. So I'm jumping up from the microphone for a minute without touching any wires.
Yeah, yeah.
We're talking about hearts.
Oh, yeah.
I have to show you something. This amazing thing, which I wish everyone could see. Can you see that? What does that look like to you?
A heart?
That is a heart. Believe it or not, that is the exact, because I measured it. I looked up the dimensions and then I measured this. It's the exact height, width, and depth of a human heart. And guess where I picked this up, this stone? On Westport Beach.
Did she?
Which is where Paul and Linda ran their dogs every day
when
they were living at Hyde Park Farm. And I saw this lying in the water as I was turning around from the sea to walk back to the car with my couple of minders who's up there with. And I saw this and I picked it up and I said, guys, this looks just like a heart.
Yeah.
And it is. This is. I use this. I keep this on my desk. I handle it every day. I have it as a paperweight on my desk. And this came from Paul McCartney's beach. And it is a heart. The exact size and shape. And probably the colour of what a human heart looks like. Isn't that extraordinary?
Wow.
It's a precious thing, this. I love it.
Warm and beautiful. Actually, not very warm.
It's not. It's cold as ice, but it is beautiful. But it's all about love, isn't it? And Linda was the focal point of his world. He sings it to her. It's huge and emotional, and it packs the punch, the message that love is eternal, and that love, faith, and hope are the things that get us through sadness. And he instilled those things in his children. And it's the reason why they were able to stand proudly at her memorial services when she died and not cry and not break down, because they knew that she wouldn't want them to.
Yeah.
And all of that, I feel it's... I know she was nowhere near dead yet, but this is all wrapped up in this song. The feeling that he had for her and her for him, and their children and their family, and the perfect unit that they were. Yeah, they had their ups and downs. Everybody does. Everybody fights and screams. And life is hard, even for mega-rich rock superstars. It just is. But they had an understanding of the fundamental important things almost from the start together. And this song sums that up.
Yes.
It's a pretty moving number. You hear
it really
when you think about it. But... it is. This song, like, that, you know, the lyrics, it's a love so warm and beautiful, never fades away. It's as simple as a bowl of rice, isn't it? But it's what he stood for and what he stands for, I think. And it has to be the reason why he, as an artist, and his music have stood the test of time.
Definitely. His quote, reiterating what you're saying, on a more personal level, the main inspiration for the song was Linda. There was no sadness associated with Linda, except when she later became ill. In that way, I think it's oddly prophetic. We had a very good relationship, but like all relationships, it wasn't perfect. We'd sometimes disagree and get annoyed with each other. But that's how families function. She's a fun person to be with, very amusing, very witty. She had a great take on life, and of course, it's very artistic. There really wasn't a lot of sadness about her at all. She was an upbeat lady. Over 20 years later, I reworked the song to be played at a string quartet at a memorial concert.
Both of them, yeah. One in New York and one in London.
Yeah.
And you'd think that would have had them all in bits. But no, he stood proudly. No regrets. And people say, oh, if you love somebody that much, how could you go on to be in another marriage? And he's had another two marriages since then. Well... surely that's the reason you try to recreate the thing that you've lost. Second time was disastrous, as it turned out. Third time, because he's in a different phase of his life now, and what he and Nancy have together must be very different from what he and Linda had. But there's no competition from a deceased spouse.
No.
Is there?
Absolutely. So, Leslie Ann Jones, Wings at the Speed of Sound, what's this album mean to you?
It resonates with a particular time in my life, as all albums do. When we're young and we collect the music of the artists we adore, it takes me right back to that period of my life and how much Paul McCartney meant and how that... Well, I'm going to get emotional now. How that love for him that I had as a schoolgirl has never waned.
Bless your heart.
I have my heart in my hands here. No, it really hasn't. And if anything, it's grown over the years. And it's been a thrill to be in his company on various occasions. And a real honour to spend a year of my life writing about him. And going to places that are associated so strongly and directly with him, and to retrace his footsteps and to revisit and explore and try and understand the life behind the music. Because we know that what this album, all the albums mean to us, mean totally different things to him. And it's a question of reaching inside the songs and the way they juxtapose and finding the clues to who he really is.
Leslie Ann Jones, thank you so much.
Thank you. Silly talk.